In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Time to talk movies. It's Pass the Popcorn, brought to you by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, Stillwater Avenue, Bangor, where they have a film for everybody in the family. Alan Adams from The Main Edge right here in studio. Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you as well.
Busy weekend for you.
A minute, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I've been calling in and stuff.
Right.
You know, out there in the world doing crap.
Yeah.
The worst.
Carrie and I showered. At least one of us is wearing deodorant, so we hope you're not offended by us and we'll come back again.
No, it's fantastic. Although if you'd let me know that Robbins dude was here, I might have given it a miss.
I wasn't going to tell you that in advance. Come on. Now.
You know, it's funny. I was listening on the way over here, so I heard you mention it. But easily my favorite place in town, Nocturnum.
Yeah,
easily. I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna go home and walk the dog, and then I'm going to flight night, man.
There you go.
Like that's become a very real tradition for Sheridan and myself.
And they do such a great job there.
Well, the food's great, the beer's great, the service is great.
Yeah.
Like literally everything is great. Right. So why would you not want to go there?
What more do you need?
I'm just saying.
And speaking of Zach Robbins, focus group, part of a highly successful presentation, old style variety show from Her Majesty's Cabaret.
Man, I tell you what, those guys worked so hard to pull off this show, and it really showed. Like, I mean, it's, you know, there were easily 150 people at the Bangor Arts Exchange. Could have been more, honestly. I know that capacity is 150, so that's what I will say was there. Just an absolute delight. The HMC folks did great work with their sketches and their videos, some just great stuff from them. Just a wonderful collection of talent also participating from the folks of the focus group. We had a great time. The music of When Particles Collide and the wonderful choral work of DeVisi. And then Stevie Dunham McGarry and the Robinson Ballet crew doing the Nutcracker in 7 minutes, which was hilarious and fantastic.
On a stage about the size of our table here. Right?
Yes. Just great work. And like everyone brought something very, very different and very exciting to the table. And it was just 2 hours of an absolutely great show. And, you know, my hat's off to them because putting the logistics of putting something like this together, it's no joke. And they really pulled it off.
Excellent. Excellent. Let's talk movies. You saw not one, not two, but three.
I did. I saw three movies. We can start with the crowd pleasing sequel. We can start with the effort at awards bait, or we can talk about the dumpster fire that Michael Bay made for Netflix. What would you like to discuss?
Well, you know how much I love it when you talk dumpster fire. So, well, let's start with the new Clint Eastwood movie that a couple of months ago looked like a surefire awards bait, but now with some of the reaction to people from what appears to be something that didn't happen that he created for dramatic effect. Now there's been a little pushback and not a good weekend at the box office.
It's hard because on the one hand, when you're making a movie about a real person and real events, on the one hand, there's a certain expectation of veracity. It's like, you know, that, okay, so you're telling me that this is a true story. So let's get the facts right. But on the other hand, there has to be some creative flexibility with regards to building dramatic narrative. Like that's something else that we as moviegoers have to understand. So this is not about, you know, having some flexibility with regards to the way events played out. It's more of a fundamental issue. It's the perpetuation of the idea that that female journalists will use their sexuality in an effort to gain information, turning it into a transactional sort of thing. That trope exists in a lot of movies. And as someone who admittedly is sort of only tangentially a journalist, but still, it's nonsense. It's a big pile of nonsense, and people should know better, especially in Clint Eastwood should know better.
Yeah.
Honestly. And so it's difficult to sort of compartmentalize that aspect of things because I do find it particularly off-putting, the idea that you would sort of create that kind of narrative, which is admittedly a very brief subplot in the movie. Brief enough where you could have done without it. Like there were a million ways to make this work without introducing that element. And so that's neither here nor there. It likely speaks to Mr. Eastwood's personal beliefs more than a lot of his movies in recent years have, honestly. Like, I think across the board, this movie does a lot of that. For those who are unfamiliar, it's the story. Richard Jewell is the story of Richard Jewell, the security guard who discovered a pipe bomb planted in Centennial Park in Atlanta during the 1996 Olympics, warned people and was his discovery prevented a good deal more bloodshed than actually took place. The bomb did go off. About 100 people were injured. 2 people died. But it could have been exponentially worse. But due to some overzealous federal agents, he became a person of interest in the event, fitting any number of profiles. And here's the thing. Yes, you should investigate that guy. Like, that isn't the problem. The problem is that it was made almost immediately public, and that alters the story in some pretty significant ways, leading to a man who is admittedly flawed and definitely an oddball, a weirdo, with some troubling aspects to his personality and to his past. But fitting the profile doesn't make you guilty.
Right.
And that's kind of what this story is about. The fact that it is possible for an innocent man to have enough, cards stacked against him that he could potentially be, guilty without the presumption of innocence. Thanks only to a lawyer that he had made the acquaintance of years earlier, a gentleman by the name of Watson Bryant. That man and his mother, that was all that stood between him and going to jail for a crime that ultimately he didn't commit. Mm. Again, we discussed the problematic aspect of the journalist, Kathy Scruggs, a writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, played by Olivia Wilde in this movie, and the aforementioned overzealousness of the FBI, led by Agent Tom Shaw, played by John Hamm. And it's funny because the two of them are almost mustache twirling in their villainy. Like the performances that they give are so over the top that it almost flattens them, which is kind of counterintuitive, but I think you know what I mean.
Right.
It's just there's a lack of dimension there that just makes them sort of cartoon characters in a lot of ways. That being said, some of the performances in this movie are absolutely exceptional. I don't know how familiar you are with Walter Paul Hauser, Paul Walter Hauser, the guy who plays Richard Jewell. Most people probably remember him from his turn in I, Tonya as Jeff Galooly's meat-headed associate.
Okay.
But he does not cut the sort of physical figure that you often see front and center in Hollywood movies. But he really finds a way to, like, his performance is subtle in the ways that his physicality by definition is not. And so it's this wonderful combination. He's really talented, and it'll be interesting to see what happens to him going forward, because there's just not a lot for someone like that.
Right.
But again, he's incredibly talented, and you can see the possibility of others like Eastwood finding specific roles for him. Like, he's that good. Then you've got like Sam Rockwell playing the lawyer, Sam Rockwell, who is excellent because Sam Rockwell is always excellent, although and at least he's not a racist in this one, which is kind of nice. He's had a run of those sorts of characters. But even here, in his, like, he plays Bryant with a very deep seated irascibility. It's like he tries to be so unlikable that he comes out the other side and becomes like charming. Which is, it's that sort of thing's so hard to pull off, and he does it, and it looks effortless. And then playing Bobby Jewell, Richard Jewell's mom, is Kathy Bates, who's excellent and will warrants every bit of it award season attention she's already got. I imagine, I know she got nominated for the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress. Don't be surprised if you see her name on the list of nominations come Oscar time, because she's very good. And she has one killer scene in particular. But yeah, it's other than the sort of problematic aspect of it, it's pretty straightforward. And there's no denying that Eastwood, whatever you think of his politics, is an old school craftsman when it comes to filmmaking. It has that sort of shagginess that that Eastwood movies do, because, you know, there are moments where you're like, oh, maybe you could have used another take there, Clint. But, you know, he's notorious for doing it in as few as possible. Like, the turnaround time on this, they started shooting like this summer, I think. Wow. Like, I mean, just a ridiculous turnaround time. But when you have a process like he does, like, you can make that work. You know, the one thing you could say about Clint Eastwood, you're not going to make him hurry. And, you know, so the pacing, there's a languor to it. It occasionally gets to be a little bit glacial, and the movie's probably 15 minutes too long because of it. I will say it was a solid movie. It was, you know, maybe not as informative as it could have been. It focused on particular aspects of the story while ignoring others, which is kind of hilarious when you think about it, because that's one of the fundamental underpinnings of the story he's trying to tell. So there's a fun little irony there. One wonders if Mr. Eastwood is aware of said irony, but but who knows? You know, he's the man with no name, so I'm just gonna go ahead and give him a pass. Grandpa gets cranky sometimes. That's all you can say.
That'll happen. All right, let's get the gang together for another Jumanji movie.
Well, you know, and we talked about this when the first one came out a couple of years ago. I liked I liked Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. Like, I liked that movie. I find Dwayne the Rock Johnson to be utterly charming. He's a wonderfully charismatic figure on the screen, and this sort of movie where he gets to, you know, embody be the body of a video game character, but, you know, sort of play a scared teenager. Like, that's a fun fit for him. More of the same here. Like, Jake Kasdan's not reinventing the wheel. Like, the first one made almost $1 billion. So it's like, you know what? Like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
Basically, we have the gang from the old, from the last movie. They've moved on with their lives a little bit. It's not that long afterwards, but they've gone off to college and stuff like that. And most of them are thriving, but Spencer, played by Alex Wolff, he was sort of the lead guy. He's the one who became The Rock last time, is struggling. He's gone to school at NYU, and he's having trouble fitting in and making friends. And so when he comes home for the holidays and all of his other friends want to get together, he's hesitant. So instead he holds up at home, despite the fact that he comes home to discover that his grandpa Eddie, played by Danny DeVito, is convalescing from a hip surgery and staying in his room. So he's basically bunking with grandpa for the holidays, which, you know, everyone knows how awesome an experience that is.
Well, it'd be different if your grandpa was Danny DeVito.
I suppose that's true. And so he's struggling a little bit and wants, you know, to sort of feel feel powerful, feel engaged, feel something special. And so he decides that he's going to repair the Jumanji video game system so he can be that hero again. Well, doesn't go quite as young Spencer planned. His friends show up at his house the next day looking for him. Where they encounter Grandpa Eddie and Grandpa Eddie's long estranged friend and partner, Milo, played by Danny Glover, who has conveniently showed up at this time after 15 years of estrangement. They go down to the basement. They realize what Spencer has done. They pick up the controllers and get pulled into the video game again, but not quite in the same way, because while Martha has returned as Ruby Roundhouse, the karate expert, played by Karen Gillan, Fridge, the erstwhile college football player, is now occupying the doughy form of Jack Black. Jack Black now. The Rock, Dr. Smolder Bravestone, and Mouse the Zoologist, played by Kevin Hart, are now occupied by Grandpa Eddie and Milo, respectively. And so you've got old guys who don't understand video games being thrust into a real-life video game in order to go on an adventure, a new adventure, which involves rescuing some sort of magical gem from the clutches of Jürgen the Brutal, played by Rory McCann, best known as the Hound from TV's Game of Thrones. And they basically have to make their way through this place to find this gem, and along the way, hopefully, track down Spencer, who is apparently occupying the body of yet another character. Many characters, new characters and old, will be reintroduced, including the unfortunately named Seaman, played by Nick Jonas, and new characters, including a thief named Ming, played by Awkwafina, and a horse. There's a horse as well, who is a character in the game. I'm not going to talk about the plot of this movie anymore because it doesn't really matter. The plot, there's a lot of big action set pieces that are a lot of fun, and there's some quippy dialogue, but the highlight, and it's something I didn't know I needed until I saw it, is The Rock doing Danny DeVito.
Really?
Yeah. Like, it's like, it's an effort to catch the physical mannerisms and the vocal mannerisms of Danny DeVito. And it's a credible job. Like, he does all right. Doesn't do as well as Kevin Hart doing Danny Glover, who is exceptional, but it's still pretty solid.
But now you've made me want to see it.
You know what I mean? It's such, like, just little things like that. And it's like, everyone's having fun. Like, everybody's clearly having a good time. And that's the point of movies like this. You're not walking into Jumanji The Next Level looking for an Oscar winner. Like, you're just going to turn your brain off for a couple hours, watch a bunch of big action stuff, some clever jokes, have some fun at the expense of both boomers and millennials alike. And then, and everything, it's going to work out happily ever after, because that's how these movies work. And, 2 years from now, we'll get Jumanji 3 and so on and so forth. Like, that's just how it's going to work. And it's fine. It's fun. I had a good time. Not quite as good as the first one. Well, the second one. But pretty good nonetheless.
All right. And finally, the third in our triumvirate this afternoon on Netflix. Yes, indeed. Michael Bay doing what he does.
Holy crap,
Six Underground. I've only seen the trailer, and that looked awful.
It's unbelievable. And look, I love what Netflix is doing, this idea of sort of reaching out to these auteur types and just basically giving them a blank check. And it's like, what's something that you've always wanted to make but haven't been able to do? It's the sort of thing that gets you The Irishman or Marriage Story or Roma from last year. Yeah. Like, you know, that's like when you hand that sort of freedom, financial freedom to a gifted filmmaker, that's the sort of wonderful stuff that you get. Sort of incredible stuff. But here's the thing. Incredible doesn't always mean good. there's no disputing the fact that Six Underground is incredible. As in, it is not credible that someone paid hundreds of millions of dollars to make this movie. But here we are. But look, Michael Bay is, love him or hate him, like, he is undeniably an auteur. Like, he is... it's singular in his vision. His vision just consists of explosions and misogyny. Like, that's basically what Michael Bay brings to the table. And there's a whole lot of that in Six Underground.
But is that enough?
Look, man, I could sit here and try to tell you the plot. Like, and I watched it this morning. It's not like it's sitting like, you know, a couple of days in the past. Like, I watched this very recently. I don't know how to tell you what this movie's about, Rich.
So is it that you don't remember the plot, or you're not sure there was one?
There wasn't much of one.
Okay, all right.
The basic gist is the six in the title of the Six Underground. It's a team of air quote ghosts, and these are people who have faked their own deaths for various reasons and have gone off the grid to form a team to right the wrongs that the powers that be cannot write. And they are led by one, played by Ryan Reynolds, who is he's the leader of the team who has assembled them. He's also a genius billionaire, because why not?
Sure.
You've got the rest of the there's two, played by Melanie Laurent, who's the sort of ex-CIA operative. There's three, the failed hitman. There's four, the parkour guy. There's five, the doctor. And then there's six, the driver. And I don't know if you picked up on the conceit. They don't use names. They use numbers.
Numbers, yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want to have connections to these people.
Well, no, not if you're a ghost.
The mission comes first.
Sure,
Rich.
That makes sense.
The mission, such as it is the overthrow of a lazily fictionalized Central Asian stan country. I think it's Turkmenistan or Turkestan. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it's called.
And, Turdistan?
It has an evil dictator who commits war crimes against his people. Six Underground wants to overthrow him and install his more democratically inclined brother to the to the throne leadership or whatever. Never really occurs to anyone. Maybe we should try like having an actual election or whatever.
But, or a different family.
Maybe. Yeah, but that's neither here nor there, because you spend the first 45 minutes of this movie trying to figure out what exactly is going on, because it starts with a 15-ish minute car chase, and then there's a bunch of timeline jumping where we sort of find out like what these people are about. The 15-ish minute car chase that ends with the brutal death of Dave Franco, who plays number six. Spoiler alert, I guess, but it happens in the first 15 minutes, so okay. So who the heck cares? He has to recruit Seven, who's a former soldier who's disillusioned by his former leadership because of an incident that happened while he was stationed overseas in Afghanistan. And so they basically have to put together a ridiculous and convoluted plan to get this guy out of power and get his brother in. But they have to get hold of his brother, who is being kept captive in a Hong Kong penthouse, because apparently that's how brutal dictators do it.
Wow.
And so they have to rescue him from there and then figure out how to get their hands on the bad guy and get rid of the bad guy and get the good guy into the spot where the bad guy needs to go. And and along the way, you get little snippets of their background that add very little to the proceedings. And you know what? We're done. Like, I've told you all.
But
I
at
can.
Least you didn't have to go out to watch it.
Well, and that's the thing. And I got to say, I have to concede, just because it's bad, and it is bad, there is entertainment value here. It just depends on what you're looking for. Now, if you want big explosions and car chases and like parkour and gunfights and stuff, like Michael Bay knows how to, he makes that stuff look great. Like visually, it's like McDonald's. Like, You see it and you're like, oh yeah, that looks pretty good. Yeah, I want that. Meanwhile, you're thinking deep down, I don't really want that.
No.
I'll
feel bad about it later.
I'm going to regret getting it.
Yeah.
I'm going to regret having it. But right now, I want to have it. And that is Michael Bay in a nutshell. Because it is pretty, and it's like, aesthetically, like there's a lot going on. There's a lot of bright colors and stuff blows up and quippy dialogue and some weird romantic scenes where that make you question whether Michael Bay has ever actually had sex. but
okay, well,
just some weirdness, a weird dynamic between one particular sort of romantic interlude where it's like, has anyone ever done this like this? It doesn't make any sense. Ooh. But again, that's what Six Underground really brings to the table, is the utter lack of making sense. And, it's like, man, if you want to just check out for 2 hours and just have some, have some explosions and car chases interspersed with a dude like running across rooftops for a couple of hours. I mean, I suppose there are worse ways to spend your time.
It's the quarter pounder with cheese of movies. Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome.
We'll see you Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
I mean, I think we'll see. We are okay. You'll come back.
Yeah, I'll be
in studio.
I will be in town.
Okay, good.